A film studio lot reflected in a golden shield containing the letters WB, the Warner Brothers Pictures logo, and AOL Time Warner Company. A dreamlike vision of a little boy perched on a crescent moon, dangling a fishing rod, the moon casting a silvery blue light over a magical pool. The boy's fishing float ripples the water, and the reflection is gone. Fleecy white clouds part in the sky, revealing the logo, DreamWorks. Warner Brothers Pictures and DreamWorks Pictures present a Parks McDonald production. The Time Machine. 1899 Columbia University. A round-faced wall clock with Roman numerals, its minute hand ticking onto the 12 to read 3 o'clock. A landing, viewed through the eyes of an unseen character, is filled with chattering students and professors bustling their way down the university staircase. Credits appear. Guy Pearce, Samantha Mumba, Mark Addy, Sienna Guillory. The students, suited young men and a handful of women in Victorian high-necked blouses, look up, hushing their chatter respectfully as the unseen figure descends. Phila Delore, Alan Young, Amira Mumba, Yancy Arias. The figure moves through a busy corridor, groups of earnest, bespectacled young men with slicked hair moving out of the way, with Orlando Jones and Jeremy Irons. A nameplate on a wooden door at the corridor end reads, Dr. Alexander Hardigan, Applied Mechanics and Engineering. Inside, a young man with collar-length brown hair rapidly chalks a complex-looking mathematical formula on a blackboard. He stops to scrutinize the scrawled jumble of numbers and letters. Nodding emphatically, he resumes his work. He's being watched by the figure who is descending the stairs, a suited, round-faced man with a moustache, an overcoat draped over his arm.
Aren't you forgetting something?
I know, it's something to do with the third differential coefficient.
Not that. Tonight.
What?
Emma?
Alexander starts.
Almost five.
Alexander grabs a battered folder and dashes out of the classroom. The round-faced David Philby follows. New York, an evening flurry of snow dusting the rooftops. Alexander and Philby hurry along a bustling street.
My concepts for harnessing micro-energy waves rejected. The dean suggested I focus on something that might actually help mankind. Like his study on the benefits of tobacco consumption.
Alex, the problem is your ideas are a bit too radical.
The problem is with the faculty. They're dinosaurs. They're already extinct, they just don't know. You know, one day they'll be discovered by some future archaeologists and he won't know what to make of them. The dim little eyes, devoid of any curiosity.
Alex, it's your first year as associate professor. You might want to play things a little more conservatively.
You sound just like my father. Look at them, Philby. All alike. All in identical bowler hats. Do you want your students to turn out like that?
I want my students to be prepared for the realities of the world they're about to greet.
Well, I don't. I want them to run along this street and knock off every bowler they see.
Alexander makes for a house across the busy road. He goes in.
Oh, huzzah. The master's home.
Did you get it?
Hello, Mr. Philby.
Hello, Mrs. Watchett. You're looking in the pink.
Must be all the exercise I get, scampering up and down these stairs like a wee lamb.
Don't torture me. Did you get it?
I got it.
Oh, good. Let me see.
But don't you think for one moment I'm going to let you go out in that filthy jacket. Now go in there and change.
She slaps his jacket. It emits a cloud of chalk dust. She glares reproachfully, and Alexander heads into his gadget-filled lab.
And you've got another letter from that annoying little man.
Oh.
Philby picks up a mechanical toothbrush.
Go ahead, switch it on. It'll help people keep their teeth well into their 40s.
Philby eyes Alexander.
Think about having that cleaned.
Oh, who has the time? How did you know with Molly?
Know what?
That you were meant to be together.
She made the best shepherd's pie I ever tasted.
Don't you have a single romantic bone in your body?
No, I'm all bowler hat.
Philby taps a typewriter-like gadget. A display flashes, alarming him.
Why do you waste your time on that crackpot?
Because he has some very interesting ideas.
A professor at Columbia University should not be corresponding with a crazy German bookkeeper.
He's a patent clerk, not a bookkeeper, and I think Mr. Einstein deserves all the support I can give him.
Philby examines a sketch.
I wonder if we'll ever go too far.
With what?
With this, with all of this.
A city with skyscrapers.
No such thing.
Discarding his watch, Alexander chooses another.
How do I look?
Practically decent. Really, Alex, good luck tonight. She's a fine girl. She's done wonderful things for you. And don't worry, you still have that alluring smell of chalk.
Oh, gotta hurry.
Oh, that's more like it. You look a proper gentleman for once.
Well, you better hope so. If Emma turns me down, you'll be next.
Well, I'm already swooning.
She glances at Philby.
Wish me luck.
Alexander dashes out onto the street. Wearily, Mrs. Watchett stands in the doorway and dutifully holds out her hand. Alexander scoots back and grabs a small box from her. Carriage lanterns and street lamps shine like glowworms along a busy thoroughfare, a grand stone gateway to Central Park. Alexander hurries through the gateway past a flower seller. She calls to him.
Not tonight, thanks.
No, I promised her flowers.
He runs back, skidding to a halt. Mouth agape, Alexander stares in wonder at a broken-down motor vehicle belching steam. A man in a cap is peering under its seat.
Spectacular waste of money. Damn thing's always breaking down.
You need a lift?
Yes, yes.
How do you keep the water temperature stable?
There's a cantilever gasket on the fuel regulator.
The vehicle lurches forward. Alexander grabs the brake handle, stopping it.
Much obliged. I'm always forgetting the damn brake. Look, hop in. I'll give you a perambulation before it breaks down again.
Oh, I'm afraid I have a prior engagement.
Well, another time then. We perambulate here most every night.
Certainly.
The man starts the vehicle up, and Alexander watches the bone shaker chug away.
Head a horse!
Yes.
The man steers the steam-powered motor car around a statue, then heads off, a horse-drawn carriage following in its wake. Overhead, an oval moon hangs in the dark sky like an opalescent jewel. Inside the park, the moonshine elongates shadows of skaters on a lake as they glide to the music from a nearby bandstand. Milling beside the frozen lake, underneath strings of glowing lanterns, are people in fashionable attire, wrapped up against the breath-freezing cold. A queue forms outside a makeshift hire stall. A man hands a pair of skates to a waiting couple as Alexander runs past. He looks towards the lake. A young woman, in a stylish red dress, jacket and hat, skates over. Alexander, hobbling onto the ice, slips. She catches him.
You're late, Professor.
She kisses him.
As soon as I could.
He eyes her outlandishly feathered hat.
Well, they say it's all the rage in Paris. If I just picked it up $5 at Macy's. Silly, isn't it?
Very silly. I like it.
Well, where are they?
What?
The flowers. You promised me flowers tonight. Don't you even remember?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was distracted.
Well, there's something new.
He looks about.
Emma, I need to talk to you.
She nods demurely. Alexander falters under her expectant gaze. He notices a nearby couple putting on their skates.
Shall we walk through the park?
Yes.
Her arm in his, they stroll along the lakeside's snowboarded path.
Professor, you're shivering. Hope you're not coming down with something.
Well, I'm afraid I am. I'm not sleeping very well, and even when I'm awake, I'm not much use. I can't eat or think or do much of anything anymore. And the worst part is, I don't know that I'll ever be well. I think there's only one remedy, and that's for you to marry me and spend the rest of your life with me.
Emma halts and stares aghast at the tremulous Alexander. He turns to face her.
Oh, Emma, I know it's right. I know we're meant to be together. It's the only thing in my entire life I've never had to think about.
Oh, Alex.
Emma throws her arms around him.
Wait, I have something for you.
He fishes in his left-hand coat pocket. Frowning, he tries the right, then panicking, fumbles inside.
You know, the moment is rather dying here.
I know, hold on. Oh.
He finds what he's looking for, and with gloved hand holds out a small black box. He opens it up. Inside is a gold ring with a translucent oval moonstone set into it. He watches her nervously.
I know it's not a diamond.
A moonstone?
Well, it's your birthstone. I thought.
She hushes him.
Right.
Overjoyed, he grins. Then, slowly, he slips the shining ring onto her wedding finger. A smile breaks over Emma's breathless lips.
I just might cry. I couldn't help but overhear. Two fine young people starting out on the road of life. I wish you the very best.
Thank you.
And much as I hate to do this, moved as I am by your protestations of love, I'll be needing your money now.
Alexander stares.
And your jewelry, too. Yeah, I guess we could call this your first little bump on the road to marital bliss.
I don't understand.
And don't make a scene. There's no cause for that. Just give me your wallet, will you?
The man pulls a revolver from the folds of his coat.
Did you hear me, lad?
All right.
Handing over his wallet.
That's everything.
And your watch.
The robber rips off Alexander's pocket watch.
And the gloves.
As Alexander pulls off his gloves, Emma surreptitiously hides her hand behind her back. The robber grins.
And the ring.
Her face crumples.
No.
I'm afraid so, darling. And maybe he'll buy you a diamond now.
Please, not that.
The robber pushes Alexander. The gun discharges. Emma collapses into the snow. Aghast, Alexander kneels by her side.
Why did you do that? It's only a ring.
The robber flees. Alexander holds Emma in his arms, the colour draining from her porcelain cheeks. Emma's eyes flicker, then close. Her head lolls back and her delicate hand loosens its grip on his coat and falls away. Alexander stares, his taut features trembling.
Oh.
Alexander buries his face into her neck, cradling her lifeless body, the surrounding snow oozing red with blood. Viewed from above, the tragic image turns. The screen fades to black. A caption reads, 4 years later. Alexander's hand moves swiftly over a blackboard positioned high on his laboratory wall. His long hair matted, Alexander stands atop a ladder, deftly chalking numbers, shapes, and figures. Alexander shifts the ladder along. Similar blackboards cover the entire length of the lab wall, each crammed with calculations.
What?
Gaunt and unshaven, Alexander stares fixedly at the board. Mrs. Watchett enters, looks about, then gasps, seeing him up the ladder.
Oh, sir, Mr. Philby is here.
Alexander looks at her.
Yes, sir. He insisted on coming.
Time to go away. I'm busy.
Philby barges in.
I won't go away, Alex.
Philby looks up at Alexander.
Oh, God, what's happened to you?
Alexander turns his haunted, pale face away.
I've been working.
He comes down.
You remember that? You used to care about your work.
I care more about my life and yours. I came by the house every day after the funeral, then every week, then every other month. Then I stopped coming. Did you even notice?
Alexander ignores him.
It hurt me, Alex. Very much.
And why are you here now?
There are some things I have to say to you. You may not like hearing.
I know, you're concerned. I know. I hear from Mrs. Watchett every day. But really, I need you to go.
I won't leave. Not with you hiding down here.
I'm not hiding.
You know that's what it is. Mrs. Watchett says you're in here all hours, day and night. Alex, will you please stand still and look at me?
Alexander stops in his tracks and looks awkwardly at Philby through hooded eyes.
It wasn't your fault.
Alexander lowers his eyes and shakes his head.
It wasn't my fault. Maybe we should blame Mrs. Watchett for picking up the ring from the jeweler. Or the jeweler for making it.
Philby shuts his eyes.
Or the poor bastard who tore the stone from the earth.
Alexander paces.
I should blame you for introducing me to Emma in the first place. Yes.
Alexander, nothing will ever change what happened.
Alexander rounds on him.
You're wrong, because I will change it.
Philby stares at him.
David, I appreciate your concern. I do. But I ask you to have faith in me.
Well, I want to have faith in you, Alex, but what are you doing here?
He eyes a partition.
Why don't you come by for dinner in a week, and I'll show you.
Why don't you come home with me now, Molly?
Did you not hear me, David?
Taken aback, Philby stiffens.
I can't leave when I'm so close.
Philby blinks thoughtfully.
All right, we'll continue this conversation in a week.
Philby regards him, then marches out of the machine-strewn lab. Alexander stares wistfully after his friend.
In a week, we'll never even have had this conversation.
An oblong mirror on a small table captures Alexander's face as he studies his haggard reflection. He's shaved and changed. Alexander curls his hair behind his ears, smoothing it down. He examines his pocket watches of various designs and sizes displayed in a frame. He selects one. Inside the silver lid, an inscription reads, to Alexander Forever, Emma. He winds the hands forwards to read 525, snaps it shut, then pops it into his waistcoat pocket. Lips parted, Alexander turns purposefully to the black cloth partition at the rear of the dim laboratory. Slowly, he pulls back the curtain. It reveals a huge contraption, its convoluted metal and glass components gleaming in the light-filled conservatory. He moves round the mass of glittering brass valves, tubes, fluted pipes, cogs and wheels. Impressive panels of thick reflective glass are positioned on blades at the front and rear of the machine. Alexander's time machine gleams new and unused like a huge brass generator. Alexander climbs onto a leather-backed armchair in the centre of the machine. The rear glass panel hangs over his head like a huge crystal parasol. He delves in his pocket and pulls out a small pendant, framing a sepia portrait of Emma. He hangs it over the complex instrument panel in front of him, then picks up a brass rod with a crystal ball at its tip. He slots the rod into the instrument panel, then glances down at three gauges, their needles fluctuating. One appears stuck. With gloved thumb, Alexander taps the gauge, freeing the needle, then releases a brake at the side of his chair. The parasol-shaped panel behind him starts to revolve. The glass panel drums at the front of the machine also whir into action. Alexander looks over his shoulder at the panels as they gather speed. Suddenly, a blue shaft of light bursts from the front panel. Shooting into the center of the rear panel above Alexander, his face set in determination, Alexander reaches for the brass rod, closing his hand over its crystal tip. A second hand on one of the hanging pocket watches begins to run backwards. It gathers momentum until the minute and hour hands begin to rewind time. The screen goes black. Punctuating the darkness, a shimmering oval moon, then the familiar sight of the park, bandstand and skaters on the lake. As before, people mill excitedly before the bandstand. The hire man hands over skates to a young couple. The couple head off, revealing Emma standing dreamily in the queue. Alexander at the lakeside is looking about for her. Emma spies him, and with a bemused smile, makes her way over. Turning his drawn face, Alexander catches sight of her. She smiles, quickening her pace, Alexander staring rapt as she approaches.
You're early. That's a first.
He stares at her, amazed. She eyes him coyly.
Well, where are they?
He stares at her, utterly transfixed.
What? The flowers?
She looks earnestly at him.
You promised me flowers tonight. Don't you even remember?
Holding her cheeks, he plants a forceful kiss full on her lips. Grimacing, Emma looks out the corner of her eye at the shocked bystanders. Alexander breaks the kiss and hugs her tightly. His expression hardens, and he pulls back to look at her.
Emma, I need to talk to you.
She gulps expectantly.
Should we walk through the park?
No. No.
He looks nervously towards the bushes.
No, let's go into the city.
He leads her away.
Alex, what is it?
Nothing, let's just hurry.
Running alarms all very well for you. You're not wearing a corset.
They clamber into a hansom cab.
Be quick about it!
Alexander shouts up to the driver, who flicks the reins, and the carriage lurches off. The carriage picks its way through a busy street, passing a street-side clock reading 5 minutes to 6. The carriage pulls up. Alexander emerges and looks in wonder up and down the street. He holds his hand out for Emma.
Oh, now you're all gallant!
Taking his hand, she jumps from the cab. As they stroll, Alexander grips Emma's arm tightly. He stares at her as they cross a road.
Professor, you're shivering. I hope you're not coming down with something.
No. I'm fine. I'm wonderful. walking down the street with you again.
Oh, we took a walk 3 days ago.
Well, not like this. Never like this.
Emma sees the steam-powered motor car pass.
Look at that now.
I've seen it.
Now I know you're ill. You're passing up the chance to explore some new gadget.
It's only a machine.
Alexander, tell me what's going on. Is something wrong?
No. No. Emma, listen to me. I need to leave you now, but I want you to go straight home and stay there. I promise you I'll come by sometime later tonight. It won't seem to make any sense. I'll be all upset that you didn't meet me in the park, but you must trust me. Everything will be all right. Just know how much I love you. How much I'll always love you.
He smiles, lost in her gaze. Tearful, she looks down.
All right. But first, where are my flowers?
Alexander spies a florist's shop over the road.
Flowers it is. Wait right there. Don't move.
Alexander races across the road, leaving Emma. The steam-powered car is parked up nearby. The elderly shopkeeper looks up as Alexander enters. Outside, the car lurches forwards.
Can I help you, sir?
Yes, a dozen rows of swipe. No.
It collides with an oncoming horse and cart. Perturbed, Alexander exits the shop. Outside, a gathering crowd stares across the street. Open-mouthed, Alexander follows their gaze across the road to where two men, assisted by a policeman, are moving the overturned cart. The men let the heavy cart down and stare gravely at the curb. Emma's prostrate body, her red dress powdered with snow, lies motionless. Alexander stares at her, utterly aghast. The screen fades to black. A hospital. Philby descends a staircase and approaches a reception desk.
I'm looking for Professor Hardigan.
The receptionist points out Alexander, who's sitting on a nearby bench. Philby hurries over to him.
Alex, I'm so sorry.
This was not supposed to happen.
Of course not. I know there's nothing I can say.
We're out of the park, Philby. We were safe.
Alexander stares fixedly ahead.
Why can't I change it? I could come back 1,000 times. See her die 1,000 ways.
I don't understand.
I can't find the answer here. Not here.
Deep in thought, Alexander lifts his haggard gaze.
Not now.
Emma's portrait dangles from a brass chronometer set into the instrument panel of the time machine. Alexander stares at the portrait, then fishes the crystal lever from his jacket and slots it into the panel. He releases the machine's brake, the parasol panel rotates behind him. A blade of light bursts from the front panel. Alexander pulls up a folding footplate and secures it onto the machine. Concentric circles of glass extend telescopically over the electric blue beam. The whirring panels, front and back, spew out rays of brilliant white light which pierce the conservatory roof, punctuating the night sky. The light intensifies, then with a brilliant flash, traps the time machine in a blue phosphorescent sphere. Inside the ghostly bubble, Alexander inches the crystal lever forwards. The dials on the brass chronometer read 1899, Jan the 18th. The end dial begins to turn, ticking over to make the 19th. Alexander looks upwards through the shimmering sphere out to the conservatory as time speeds up outside it. He watches the winking sky as night follows day, then an arc of golden sunlight moving over a pale blue sky as night and day become one. A creeping vine smothers the conservatory, sprouts glorious white flowers, then withers away as a covering of winter snow blankets it. Summer returns, banishing the winter gloom, and the vine comes again, its flowers flourishing once more. Alexander watches as a blurred figure zooms about his lab, emptying it of tools, machines, and books. Stacked boxes appear as the lab is transformed into a garage, its doors flapping as blurred motor cars come and go. The dresses in the shop window opposite change styles in bewildering succession, the mannequin's skirts shortening as the years roll by. Alexander reaches for Emma's portrait. It slips from his hands, bouncing out of the sphere. He thrusts his hand out of the bubble. Attempting to retrieve it, he burns his hand and the pendant falls to the ground. He watches ruefully as Emma's decaying photograph melts away. The conservatory and house are replaced by modern buildings rising up around the glowing sphere. A propeller plane zooms over the city. A skyscraper grows. The New York metropolis spreads below jet planes as they soar through scudding clouds. The Earth grows distant until viewed from outer space. A satellite, then a space station pass by on their elliptical orbit. Eventually, the Earth is eclipsed as the moon looms into view. A spaceship arcs down towards a futuristic city glowing on the moon's surface. A caption on a flickering video screen reads, "The future is now." Alexander peers inquisitively through the sphere and begins to ease back the lever. Hordes of people appear underneath the advertising screen, their speeded motion gradually slowing.
The future is now.
Server restrictions apply. Blackout periods and availability subject to change. For full details, contact lunarleisurelist.com.
The date on the chronometer reads 2030, May 24th. Alexander applies the brake, steps down into an alleyway, and makes his way towards the busy street, staring rapt at the screen.
The latest update from Lunar Leisure Living. Our engineers are currently preparing for the first 20 megaton detonation to create the subterranean living chambers for Lunar Leisure Living. Imagine fishing in our fully stocked Sea of Tranquility, golfing on our championship course, home of the Neil Armstrong Open. 100-yard drives, oh, no problem! And at 1/6 Earth's gravity, you're guaranteed to get back on the dance floor. So contact Lunar Leisure Living today to reserve your own little piece of heaven, because the future is now.
A young woman swipes a card through her bike lock. It opens. She sees Alexander.
Hey. Hello?
Nice suit. Very retro.
He nods politely at her.
Thank you.
She flashes a smile, then sees the time machine.
That makes a hell of a cappuccino.
Straight-faced, he ponders this. Alexander smiles weakly at her.
I see ya.
Hi, friend.
She grabs up her bicycle and joins the other bike-pushing pedestrians. Alexander, in awe of his new surroundings, heads off to explore the city.
Lunar Leisure Living.
The 2030 New York City skyline. Sleek, curved glass skyscrapers dwarf the Empire State Building as old buildings rub shoulders with the new. The lion statues outside the Fifth Avenue Library standing proud in the shadows of the new futuristic towers. Alexander makes his way inside the library.
Alright, attention everyone! Class 23, could we gather please?
Ready.
Our next stop is Antiquities. Please make sure that your micro scans are charged for download. 2x2, let's look lively. 2x2. And Tom, if you do that again, I will resequence your DNA, so help me. Now march.
Alexander stares at a round black sphere in the center of the library's marble hall. He walks on through, passing some freestanding glass panes in the aisle. He stops to look at an old bookcase. A man appears at one of the panes.
Welcome to Vox System. How may I help you?
Well, I didn't see you there.
Always seem to have that effect. How may I help you, sir?
Alexander points at the sphere.
What is that thing?
That is my photonic memory core, or PMC as we say in the trade.
The man passes between the glass panes, disappearing in the gap between them. Alexander steps back, shocked. The man stares from behind another pane. Alexander takes a look behind it and is amazed to see no one there.
Over here, sir.
Alexander steps in front of the glass, and the man reappears.
What are you?
I'm the Fifth Avenue Public Library Information Unit. Box registration NY-114. How may I help you?
Oh, a stereopticon of some sort.
Stereopticon? Oh, no, sir. I am a third-generation fusion-powered photonic with verbal and visual link capabilities connected to every database on the planet.
Alexander leans into the pane.
Photonic?
The hologram leans too.
Compendium of all human knowledge.
Oh.
Area of inquiry?
Do you know anything about physics?
Ah, accessing physics.
Mechanical engineering. Dimensional optics. Phrenography. Temporal causality. Temporal paradox.
Computer images appear on the glass.
Yes.
The Vox hologram sighs.
Accessing science fiction.
No, no, practical application. My question is, why can't one change the past?
Because one cannot travel into the past.
Vox turns, then disappears, moving along the panes in the hall.
What if one could?
One cannot.
Excuse me, this is something you should trust me on.
Accessing the writings of Isaac Asimov, H.G. Wells, Harlan Ellison, Alexander Hardigan.
Oh, tell me about him.
Alexander Hardigan, 1869 to 1903, American scientist given to eccentric postulation. Bound writings include Treatise on the Creation of a Time Machine.
Tell me about the time machine.
Time Machine was written by H.G. Wells in 1894. It was later adapted to a motion picture by George Pal and a stage musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber, which ran on Broadway for 23 years. Would you like to hear selections from the score?
No.
There's a place called tomorrow, a place of joy.
Not of sorrow, can't you see? It's a place for you.
Thank you,
man.
That's quite enough.
The Vox choir vanishes. Alexander heads off.
No. I think I'll have better luck in a few hundred years.
Live long and prosper.
Alexander inches forward the lever of the time machine. The machine jolts, throwing Alexander against the chronometer. Alexander pulls the rod back. The dials on the chronometer read 2037. Alexander looks toward the street. Gone are the screen and pedestrians. Instead, it looks war-torn and ravaged, with crumbling buildings, burnt-out vehicles, and sporadic fires burning. The night air is thick with smoke. An armored vehicle rumbles past. Alexander picks his way down the blackened alley, staring aghast at the wreckage. Suddenly, an armored vehicle swings into the alley ahead of him, its rooftop searchlight blinding him as two helmeted guards approach.
Sir! Where's your designated evacuation center?
Sir, you are subject to arrest under martial law.
Please put your hands out, sir. Palms together. You will be held in detention until your evacuation center clears you for transport.
Wait,
just take it easy.
Hey, we gotta get out of here.
Wait, how did this happen?
The moon. Come on, move it.
Alexander looks up. The moon is disintegrating.
That's impossible. What happened?
What, you've been living under a rock?
Yes, I've been living under a rock. Now tell me.
He breaks free of the guards. They exchange a look.
The demolitions for the lunar colony screwed up the orbit, okay? The moon's breaking up, all right? Come on.
They grab him. Suddenly, the Earth shakes.
Forget him! Come on!
The guards run for their vehicle, abandoning Alexander. The alley splits apart, a huge fireball leaping up through the gash. Alexander leaps on the time machine and pushes forward the lever. An explosion rocks the machine, throwing him against the instrument panel. He lolls unconscious in his chair as the chronometer dials spin faster and faster, the months blurring as the machine speeds into the future. Fiery orange skies roll over the glowing sphere amongst a vast desert landscape in the grip of a giant sandstorm. The Earth's surface evolves in seconds. Seas roll back from the land. A river evaporates, forming a massive desert canyon. Mountains dissolve like melting ice. Grass carpets the land about the sphere, transforming the desert into a verdant landscape. Unconscious, Alexander is oblivious to the ever-changing environment outside the sphere. Winds bring blizzards to devour the lush grassland. Then, like a great white waterfall, a huge avalanche swamps the protective sphere, trapping the time machine in an icy tomb. Alexander, his face dusted with frost, begins to awaken. Giant icebergs melt around the sphere, and fertile grasslands come again. Thick, lush vegetation engulfs the time machine. Alexander, perspiring profusely, comes to and stares blearily at the spinning dials on the chronometer. He reaches out and eases back the lever, then blacks out again. The date on the chronometer reads July the 16th, the numbered dials reading 802701. The screen fades to black. A woman's hand gently dabs a cooling wet cloth onto Alexander's scorched, blistered face. He's lying asleep under a canopy, a blanket draped over him. He stirs. He sees Emma in his dream. A young woman's face appears through the folds of the canopy, watching him.
I earned her tambourine. Turn in order.
Night turns into day. The long-haired woman pulls the blanket away from Alexander's chest and moves his hand, revealing his swollen, bruised ribcage. She gently wraps his torso with a bandage. A little boy comes up to the woman. The woman hushes the struggly-haired boy, then strokes him lovingly. Later, by torchlight, she offers a bowl of water up to Alexander's lips. He drinks from the simple ceramic bowl. Alexander yawns and rubs his eyes as sunlight streams onto his unshaven face. He blinks his eyes open, focusing on a blue and mauve lizard climbing up a bamboo pole. The lizard hisses. Alexander cocks his head, watching it, then reaches out to push back the chiffon-like drapes hanging around his bed. Lifting his head, he takes a look at his surroundings, a hut-like dwelling, ramshackle and primitive-looking, his bed makeshift, a coarse blanket covering him. Sitting up, he touches his lower back and winces in pain, then peers through the drapes.
Hello?
He listens to the birdsong outside, then notices his neatly folded jacket and trousers beside the bed. He lifts the blanket to check his state of undress, and seeing his nakedness underneath, reaches out for his trousers. As Alexander dresses, the long-haired young boy appears beside his bed. Alexander pulls on his waistcoat and turns to see the boy. They eye one another warily.
Hello. Don't be afraid.
Lex.
The boy heads off.
Oh wait, don't go.
Jumping down onto a lower platform, Alexander follows. Oh. Alexander climbs down onto an external ledge. He starts, shocked by the view that greets him. A sheer drop into a huge canyon below, Alexander stares at hundreds of wooden fan-like dwellings clinging to the canyon walls, each with bamboo balconies overlooking the crevasse. Alexander sees the boy on an upper balcony.
Wait, I just want to talk to you.
The boy shouts out.
Nanam Jemwell! Nanam Jemwell!
Alexander peers over the edge. Rope ladders descend from the balcony down to a river where boats are moored at the cliff face. People climb up the ladders towards the strange wooden dwellings. The cliff face village comprises of hundreds of dwellings, fluted wooden fans attached to the rock face with ropes and bamboo. People clad in woven robes, the women with long raven hair, the men's heads shaved, climb or descend into connecting rope ladders and converge around his balcony.
Hello.
A man approaches him.
I'm sorry, I don't understand you.
Do you know my words?
Yes.
Lennon Jemwell Lex.
It's the young woman who nursed him.
The Lex. The stone language.
The stone language? But do you understand me?
We all learn it when we're young. They told Jen. Forget. They forget it. But I teach.
When do talpax? When to Eloy Tastol Dalquin? And then don't Jowen for Anton Mass?
To Jen! And I'm all Totan Wen. When to talpax.
What is he saying?
They're trying to decide if we should throw you in the river. Tell me quickly and tell me the truth. Where do you come from?
Well, actually, I'm from here. Just not from now. You see, I built a machine that allows me to travel through time. And I'm from the past.
She narrows her eyes.
Oh.
She addresses the villagers.
Wentor dir tan nov tan quin. Stanmen marwin tan furon. Em quin nov tan quin. Em porkalon wensarim.
She thumps her forehead and laughs. The villagers join in.
I told them you hit your head and you are a wandering idiot.
Alexander looks bemused. The villagers start to disperse. Torren, the shaven-headed young tribesman, eyes Alexander suspiciously, then heads off. Alexander shouts down to the retreating woman and boy.
What are you doing?
Getting ready for the moor. The night.
Oh. I'll come with you.
The villagers pull up their boats from the river, the setting sun bathing the clifftop village in a languid golden hue. Inside the young woman's dwelling, she questions Alexander as the little boy toys with his pocket watch.
Eloy.
What are your people named?
Well, I guess you'd call us New Yorkers.
New Yorkers? Aren't they friendly?
Until you talk to them.
Alexander smiles at the boy.
Tell me about your village.
Oh, it's a very busy place. Everyone seems to be in a hurry. They all wear identical bowler hats. Little black round things on their heads.
What do you do there?
I was a teacher, like Mara, and I make things.
Me also. I made a sesquintan with my father. We still use it.
A sesquintan?
Mara, Darren Jemwenlin.
Sesquintan. Steps of rope.
Oh. A rope ladder.
We can make one. I will teach you.
Say under and tansom. No tansom, Alexander.
Will you tell me more, Lano, on the next day?
Tomorrow? Yes, I will. Why don't you take care of this for me tonight?
Darren Jenkinen.
Thank you.
Ender Torma Lano.
Mara takes the pocket watch from Kaelin and hangs it over the boy's bed. She kisses him goodnight and heads off. Alexander nods at the smiling boy.
Good night.
Good night.
Kaelin reaches out and strokes the dangling watch. Alexander follows Mara through the darkened dwelling.
Kaelin will tire you if you let him.
He has always been questioning.
Our parents were firm, but it is his way.
The beautiful, statuesque Mara climbs a ladder up to the balcony. Alexander follows.
Where are your parents?
They've gone from this place.
He looks at her.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Stepping onto the balcony, he looks out at the Eloy village. A light glowing within each dwelling, they resemble an array of yellow and black Chinese lanterns spread over an enormous wall. Alexander's gaze wanders to the heavens. He sees the moon torn apart, broken pieces scattered in a streak around one larger fragment. He stares transfixed at the shining debris.
You were right, Philby. I did go too far.
With me.
Alexander sits opposite Mara.
Mara, why do you pull the boats up at night? Afraid they'll be stolen?
Stolen? Do not know that word.
Well, are you afraid that someone will take them?
It is just more safe this way.
Oh.
You must do things to be safe where you come from.
Well, of course.
When you come from.
Ah, so I'm not just a wandering idiot.
She smiles and pours a drink, handing him the cup. Dreamily, she reaches down to stroke some pink wilting flowers in a small vase beside her.
Calmer. Maybe we could find some tomorrow.
He stares at her uncertainly.
Flowers?
He blinks, staring at her attractive bronzed face. She returns his gaze, fixing him with her deep brown eyes, then looks away and smiles to herself. The screen fades to black. From the darkness, strange, distorted images of flora rush by to the grisly heart of an oppressive, haunting, murky black jungle. A ghostly white face with devilish eyes appears. The journey through the black jungle speeds up. A massive metal head with cavernous eyes and huge spike teeth blocks the path. It slowly opens its horrendous jaws and lunges. Alexander awakes with a jump and hears Kaelin crying out. Alexander climbs out of bed. Mara's comforting the boy.
Bring some wind!
Bring some wind! And in Val! Bring Tanum and Morlocks. Torkalorn and in Quinn.
The boy settles back into bed.
In Barwell. In Barwell.
Mara looks up and sees the pocket watch is gone from its place above the bed. Leaving Kaelin's bedside, she sees Alexander and puts a finger to her lips, following him up out of the bedroom. Alexander turns back to her.
Is he all right?
He had a dream.
Oh. Well, so did I. I was moving through a jungle. And
you saw a shape ahead of you?
Well, a face that called my name.
We all have that dream.
She smiles knowingly.
All of you?
Yes. Now go back asleep. You're still not well.
He thinks on.
What does that mean? Morlock?
A child's dream. No more. Go back asleep.
Alexander settles thoughtfully back into his bed, pulling his blanket around him. A new day, stuck on the side of a rock, is part of an ancient tiled sign reading City Hall, Brooklyn Bridge. Alexander stares wistfully at it. There are other plaques and signs from past buildings and monuments.
Keep these stones in many places. This is the room where my parents taught me for the first time.
One of the crumbling plaques reads Tiffany & Co. Alexander stares around at the ancient relics, each carved with an inscription.
Why do you learn this language if you don't use it?
It's a tradition we hand down. It meant something once. It must be here for a reason.
He crouches to read one of the plaques.
One generation passeth away and another cometh, but the earth abideth forever.
Mara's smile fades. She moves over to him.
Why have you come here? Why have you traveled through time?
I have a question answered.
Question?
Yes, why can't I change the past?
Why would you want to?
He looks away from her inquiring gaze and stares at the ground. Mara nods knowingly.
You've lost someone.
He manages a nod.
Someone you loved very much.
He looks away from her again, swallowing hard. Mara eyes him sympathetically. Later, the pair paddle a canoe along the river.
Mara, why are there no older people here?
What do you mean?
Older people. Parents' age. Grandparents' age.
They've gone from this place.
You mean they're dead?
Yes.
All of them? How is that possible?
There are things better left not said. We don't dwell on the past, Alexander. We do something else.
What?
We remember them. With these.
Before them, erected on a tract of land beyond the canyon, are numerous structures built of bamboo, mud, stone, wood and fabric. The decorated orange fins on these monuments turn majestically, like huge weather vanes or ship's sails. Kaelin has climbed one. Kaelin slides down bamboo poles curving around the monument and jumps down into the bustling Eloi encampment. Alexander smiles at him from the canoe.
Alexander!
The boy runs excitedly over as they moor the canoe.
Are you going to work now? Come with me! No! Alexander's not well enough. We're going to see his machine. Now! Stay with Torin. Tor'Kalorn. And Imjelnotin.
Go on the next day. Tomorrow.
I need to see that it's all right.
Fabri went so well.
Alexander follows Mara. Kaelin shouts after him.
Will you tell me more about New York tonight?
I will.
Mara and Alexander head off into a forest, leaving the encampment and the toiling Eloi tribespeople as they build another monument. In the distance, like a field of sun-basking butterflies, the sails of the Eloi monuments turn gently in the wind. Behind, the river stretches to the mouth of the Great Canyon, a vast black mountain range rising above it. Alexander and Mara emerge from the other side of the forest. Coming to a clearing, Mara grows cautious, her thick brows furrowed as she looks over her shoulder. Alexander approaches the time machine. Alexander walks around the gleaming machine, inspecting it.
Oh, good. It seems fine. We had quite a ride together.
It's ready.
Appears so.
You'll use it now. Go back to your own time.
Well, I guess I could. It seems so long ago.
No, you should go. And I need to ask. Will you take Kaelin with you?
Why?
Alexander, take him away. Back to your time. Will you do that?
Mara, why?
Please. You don't know. Take him away from here. Kaelin!
Alerted, Mara suddenly charges back towards the forest. Puzzled, Alexander gives chase. Mara sprints like the wind through the undergrowth, Alexander just behind.
What's going on?
Go early! We must get Kaelin!
As he runs, Alexander glimpses a huge two-legged creature charging through the trees. Vaulting a ridge, Alexander sees the terrified Eloi fleeing for their lives. They splash through a stream in their panic. Alexander watches as the Eloi flee. He's startled by a scream behind him. He falls backwards, staring up at a Morlock as it lifts its grotesque head. Fearful, Alexander joins the stampede. A spiny-backed Morlock with a blowpipe jumps in front of some Eloi. An Eloi man falls, a dart piercing his shoulder. Mara screams. The Morlocks pick villagers off with their blowpipes. Mara falls. Alexander rushes to her aid, pulling the sharp-tipped dart from her shoulder, blackened by its poison. Scrambling to her feet, Mara runs on. Alexander sniffs the dart's tip. He sees a crouching Morlock target another Eloi man. Alexander, hiding behind rocks, watches the carnage. Eloi emerge from the bamboo forest, charging over the sand towards their boats. Suddenly, clouds of sand erupt as more Morlocks burst up out of the ground, surrounding the Eloi. The Eloi cower in the bamboo thicket as the bulbous-headed creatures surround them, shaking thick clouds of sand from their long, matted locks. The creatures' skull-like faces snarl. One charges. The terrified Eloi scramble back through the bamboo forest as the Morlocks hunt them down. Eloi scatter. The giant creatures are amongst them. One swipes its huge arm, sending an Eloi flying. Another advances on a petrified young man. It grabs the man and hurls him into the air. The creature then launches itself onto the prostrate Eloi and stamps on his back. It binds the man's feet and drags him over the forest floor. Alexander sees another Morlock head off a group of Eloi. They flee as it lifts its blowpipe. A curly-haired woman yanks a dart from her arm. She flees into a Morlock's path. Another jumps on her, then throws her over its shoulder. A Morlock lassoes an Eloi, yanking him violently backwards. The creature carrying the curly-haired woman steps onto a bank and disappears down into the sand, dragging her with it. The lassoed man is pulled under the sand too. Alexander hears Kaelin. Mara looks up. A dart protrudes from Kaelin's leg. Turning to see a Morlock heading for him, Alexander ducks behind a rock. The creature vaults over him, heading for Kaelin. The boy flees. Alexander runs to grab Mara.
No, stay here! Stay in the group!
Alexander chases the Morlock. Kaelin trips and falls. He looks up trembling as the creature towers over him. He tries to escape. It blocks his path. Suddenly, Alexander slams into the fiend. It falls. Kaelin escapes. The beast narrows its sickly eyes. Alexander grabs a bamboo stick and thwacks the Morlock, flooring it, then beats a hasty retreat. The dazed creature gets up and launches itself into the air. Alexander sprints down a riverside path. The creature lands just behind, then propelling itself on all fours, hurtles towards him. Alexander jumps out of the way, and the Morlock careers into a bamboo thicket, snapping shoots as it skids to a halt. Alexander scrambles to his feet and climbs the bamboo poles curving about an Eloi monument. The Morlock breaks out of the bamboo thicket and stares up at the monument. With one huge leap, it manages to grab hold of Alexander's legs. Alexander kicks it. The beast falls, slamming onto the ground. Dangling, Alexander stares down at the unconscious Morlock. It opens its eyes. Alexander climbs higher up the mast-like monument, onto the decorative bamboo twine sail section turning at the very top. The Morlock gets to its feet, watching as Alexander loses his footing. He clings desperately onto the bamboo trellis under the sail and hauls himself up. The creature bounds onto the monument. It shins up and makes a grab for Alexander. Alexander cowers in a bamboo orb at the top, the Morlock pouring at him through the gaps. The Morlock breaks into the orb. They circle each other. Locked in combat, they fall, Alexander clinging onto a strut. They slam into the mast and slide down, smacking the ground. Alexander astride the beast. The Morlock flips Alexander over and puts its claws about his neck, throttling him. It jumps away when Kaelin thrusts a flaming torch at it. The beast knocks the torch from Kaelin's grip, then advances on the pair. Alerted by a distant commotion, the beast retreats. Alexander and Kaelin chase into the forest. They find Mara held aloft by a Morlock. It jumps into the sand. Alexander sprints to the hole and tries to grab Mara as the creature pulls her down, but the sand swallows her up. Alexander desperately claws the sand with his hands. Kaelin watches him. The Eloi crowd round Alexander as he scrabbles in the crater left by the creature. Giving up, he marches over to Torren, the young male villager he first met.
We have to follow them. We have to find them.
We do not call Quintor. No.
Why not?
This is Nemiloitas. Our life here.
Panting for breath, Alexander stares at Torren.
How can you just do nothing? How can Tortasan more? It is the day and the night.
The day and the night.
This is the world.
Alexander squares up to him.
Why don't you fight back?
Imtorlin?
Fight back. Why not?
Those who far Quilpaks fight are taken first.
Blinking angrily, Alexander turns on his heel and hurries over to the crater where Kaelin is kneeling.
Kaelin, do you know where they're taken?
No.
Did they ever come back? Has anyone ever followed them?
I don't know.
What about the Morlocks?
We're not supposed to talk about it.
There must be a leader. Kaelin, listen to me. Listen. Sometimes we need to accept what's happening to us, even if we don't want to. And other times we have to fight, even if we're afraid. Now, it's difficult to understand. I know. Believe me, I know. Now, they're afraid. And I'm asking you not to be. So will you tell me what you know? We can save her. Please.
When they go, we're not supposed to talk about it.
The boy stares meekly at Alexander.
But we all know of a place.
What place?
Where the ghosts are.
Dusk. The last orange tongues of light flicker over the darkening sky as the sun sets beyond the canyon. The river at the valley bottom flows in darkness, save for a distant torchlight shining in the gloom near the water's edge. The ground is black and rocky. Kaelin, carrying a torch, appears at the mouth of a crater in the ground.
Here it is.
Alexander appears at the crater's edge and stares into the cavernous chamber below. He throws a rope ladder down into the chamber. Already at the bottom, Kaelin balances his lamp on a ledge in the murky chamber as Alexander climbs down the ladder. Carved statues adorn the chamber walls, and on the shadowy floor is a large black sphere. Alexander sees the sphere and circles it, amazed. It's the photonic memory core from the Fifth Avenue Library. A blue band glows on its surface as it powers up.
Welcome to Vox System. How may I help you?
It's all right.
How may I serve you? What can I get you? Oh, let's see. Henry James.
Oh, no. Yes?
No. Too depressing.
Hemingway, perhaps. No. Too sweaty.
Plato, Poos, Pinter, Poe, Pound?
No.
The complete works of Martha Stewart.
Ah! I have it!
Jules Verne.
Right up your alley, I would think.
Photonic, right?
Oh, what's left of one? What's left of all of them?
I am the last.
And these fragments I have shored against my ruins. T.S. Eliot. You wouldn't know him yet, but he is so depressing, yet so divine.
Alexander grabs at a bookshelf. The petrified books crumble.
I'm sorry. The lending library is temporarily out of service. Not to worry, I have them all right here.
Every page of every volume. Can you tell me what's happening here?
Well, my sources are no longer fully annotated and my information is somewhat anecdotal. But I believe what was once one race is now two. One above and one below. Two distinct species that have evolved.
And how do those below survive?
That is the real question, isn't it?
Fox winks. Disheartened, Alexander turns from the hologram.
I don't believe it.
Well, if you don't like the answers, you should avoid asking the questions.
Fox moves, reappearing at another dilapidated pane.
Look at them. They have no knowledge of the past, no ambition for the future. So lucky.
Why would you say something like that?
Can you even imagine what it's like to remember everything? I remember the six-year-old girl who asked me about dinosaurs 800,000 years ago. I remember the last book I recommended, The Homeward Angel by Thomas Wolfe. And yes, I even remember you.
Fox glares at Alexander. He strides into the gloom, then stares out from the following pane.
Time travel. Practical application.
How do you know about the Morlocks if you can't leave this place?
It was one Eloy who managed to escape. He told me everything.
Fox, looking rueful, sits on a virtual rock.
We spent years together. Just talking.
Fox blinks sadly.
The conversation's a little spotty now, but I do remember.
He fingers a skull.
It's good to have a friend.
Then you can help us find the Morlocks. Find Mara.
Fox stands up at the pane.
And if the truth is so horrible, it will haunt your dreams for all time.
Alexander eyes Fox wistfully.
I think I'm used to that.
Fox lowers his gaze and blinks thoughtfully, then stares back at Alexander.
My friend said he came from the east. From the jungle.
Can you describe it?
I don't have to.
Fading a little, Fox moves between the panes.
Just follow the breathing.
Alexander plunges the murky depths, for real this time, into the black underground jungle of his nightmare. Just visible in the misty gloom, dense foliage, spiky-leaved palms, and foreboding tropical trees rush by as Alexander heads deeper into the ghostly jungle. He catches up with Kaelin, and the pair stumble into a clearing, the fanged iron head rising up in front of them.
In the dream, we're moving toward it. But I think it was meant to keep us away.
They peer from the foliage out at the statue.
I might just go on by myself.
No!
Mara would be very cross with me if you got hurt. Now I'll find her. But I need you to go back to the village and light a fire so we can find our way home. All right, will you do that for me?
I lost your pocket watch. They took it from my room. I'm sorry.
Alexander stares at the panting boy, then furrows his brow thoughtfully.
Why would they take it?
They both stare up at the huge, terrifying statue. Alexander, dwarfed by the huge structure, picks his way over the clearing to a mass of tangled metal at the base of the statue. Later, Alexander peers down into the statue from an opening. He secures a rope and throws it inside, then carefully edges himself onto the ledge and into a giant shaft within the statue, sending rocks tumbling into the gloom. He loses his footing and slips. He manages to cling on but drops the rope, which falls into the chasm, disturbing a flock of bats. The winged creatures wheel past him at close range. Alexander looks down. Leaning out from the wall, he peers down into the inky black depths of the shaft, where a stone wheel spins on the end of a thick axle. Alexander reaches the bottom of the wall, hops down onto the stone floor, then enters a tunnel. At its entrance, a barred metal wheel turns. He ventures through the dimly lit tunnel, along the top of which runs the spinning axle. A noise up ahead makes him stop in his tracks. A Morlock lollops along an intersecting tunnel. Alexander watches from the shadows as the beast crosses the opening where the two tunnels join, then disappears out of view. Emerging from his hiding place, Alexander scurries up to the crossing. Checking the lumbering beast can't see him, he leaps across the gap and moves on warily down the next section of the tunnel. Stopping, he peers through a short passage into an enormous cavern. An orange light flickers over his face. Inside, a Morlock is rhythmically shoveling fuel into a raging furnace. In the dark center of the smoky, fire-lit cave stands a tall structure supported on metal girders. From it, white-hot sparks gush down a conduit leading to the floor, where other Morlocks are busy working, surrounded by turning wheels and axles. Relaxing on a platform, one Morlock picks bugs from the hair of another and eats them. Waiting for the coast to clear, Alexander slinks on unseen past the entrance tunnel. Later, he cautiously descends steps leading down past grey stone pillars into a dingy grotto, where two large hooks hang on wires from the ceiling. At the base of the stairway, Alexander stops before a tall bundle of different fabrics resembling a seated person clothed and wearing a headdress. Alexander inches forward, then leans in towards the pile. He lifts a string of beads from the bundle and examines them with a questioning frown. Hearing a faint sound, he looks up. A hanging barbed metal pole turns. Alexander spots a long sacrificial slab into which knives have been thrust and staggers back in alarm. He knocks a wooden lever and a trap door opens. Falling down a deep pit, Alexander tries to hold onto a chain. The chain jams and he falls into a pool, over which floats a thick layer of bones and rotting flesh. His mouth gaping in horror, Alexander paddles frantically through the slippery remains, and reaching a wall tries to pull himself up, but slips. A Morlock grabs his hair. Trembling, Alexander looks up into its snarling face. A metal gate with a crisscross pattern of bars closes over the top of a sunken stairway, shutting Alexander in. He treads slowly but steadily down the solid, broad stone steps, which glisten with an eerie white light. At the bottom of the stairway is a stark, dimly lit lair. Reflections from a pool quiver on the walls and low ceiling. Alexander runs to a cage resting on the smooth floor.
Mara?
He crouches down.
Mara.
He stares at her.
Mara
stares trance-like through the bars of the small pentagonal prison. Alexander follows her gaze.
Come a little closer. I don't bite.
At the far end of the cave, a tall figure with a white face and long white hair, Uber Morlock, sits proudly on a throne. Alexander rises slowly to his feet and steps a few hesitant paces closer.
Do I surprise you?
A little, yes.
We weren't always like this. After the moon fell from the sky, the Earth could no longer sustain the species. Some managed to stay above. The rest of us escaped underground. Then centuries later, when we tried to re-emerge into the sun again, we couldn't. So we bred ourselves into castes. Some to be our eyes and ears. Some to be our muscles and sinews.
Oh, you mean your hunters?
Yes. Bred to be predators. But bred also to be controlled, you see. My caste concentrated on expanding our cerebral abilities.
You can control her thoughts.
Noth trusts theirs.
Eloy. So it's not enough that you hunt them down like animals.
That's their role here.
To be your food.
Yes. And for those who are suitable to be breeding vessels for our other colonies.
Alexander looks at Mara.
You see, I am just one of many.
I don't understand how you can sit there and speak so coldly about this.
Uber Morlock rises angrily.
Have you not considered the human cost of what it is you're doing?
We all pay a price. Alexander.
Uber Morlock turns and steps slowly away. Running down the center of his pale-skinned back is a thick mass of purple brain tissue through which vertebrae protrude.
Don't worry, you're safe. I control them. Without that control, they would exhaust the food supply in a matter of months.
Food supply? They're human beings.
Who are you to question 800,000 years?
He releases a glowing fish back into the pool.
Of evolution.
This is a perversion of every natural law.
Uber Morlock grabs him.
Time travel. But your pathetic attempt to control the world around you, your futile effort to have a question answered. Do you think I don't know you, Alexander? I can look inside your memories, your nightmares, your dreams. You're a man haunted by those two most terrible words. What if?
Open-mouthed, Alexander stares in wonder at his host, whose wide, piercing eyes are as cold and opaque as his white skin. Alexander turns his head and gazes across the cave. Alexander sees a light shining and wanders warily towards it. Now Alexander finds himself in a dark room. On an illuminated cabinet sits a carriage clock and his selection of pocket watches in their open-fronted display case. As the light increases, Alexander realizes he's standing in his laboratory. Alexander, in a smart beige suit, his hair slicked back, looks around, then frowns at a set of papers in his hand, which are covered with pencil drawings for the time machine. He looks up.
Daddy! Daddy!
At one end of the laboratory, a two-pillared archway leads into a glass conservatory full of bright sunlight and bursting with tropical plants. Emma sits with two young children. Mesmerized, Alexander folds the papers and slips them into a drawer. He then walks towards the family group, a happy smile spreading over his lips. Back with Uber Morlock.
You built your time machine because of Emma's death. If she had lived, it would never have existed. So how could you use your machine to go back to save her? You are the inescapable result of your tragedy. Just as I am the inescapable result of you.
White light spills down Alexander's face. Hearing a noise, he looks round. A thick, square platform of rock sinks slowly down a shaft and into the cave, stopping just a few feet below the floor. On the platform's smooth top, lit by brilliant white light, is the time machine, its twin parabolic panels fully open and revolving in synchrony. Alexander stares searchingly at it, then steps closer. Mara peers curiously through the bars of the cage. Uber Morlock stares fixedly.
You have your answer. Now go.
Hesitating a moment, Alexander turns his eyes apprehensively to the whirring time machine, its highly polished tubes and other metal components glinting in the bright light. Then, with his blue eyes wide open and lips parted a fraction, Alexander walks steadily, almost robotically, forward. Uber Morlock, a little way behind, follows. Reaching the glinting machine, Alexander settles himself into the high-backed chair and stares firmly ahead.
I believe you have something that belongs to me.
Ubu Morlock pulls out the silver pocket watch, opens it, and stares at the white face.
We all have our time machines, don't we?
He approaches Alexander.
Those that take us back are memories. And those that carry us forward.
Mara looks on anxiously.
A dream.
Holding onto the chain, he offers the watch to Alexander, who puts his hand round the timepiece.
You're forgetting one thing.
Ubu Morlock tips his head quizzically to one side. Mara watches with interest.
What if?
Alexander yanks Ubu Morlock towards the machine, slams the control lever forward, then elbows him in the back. He then shoves Ubu Morlock against a pipe, but he retaliates with a vicious punch. The time machine is now shielded by the sphere of pale bluish light, and its chronometer is ticking round. Alexander kicks his foot into Ubu Morlock's chest. Ubu Morlock grabs his leg and hurls him backwards. Alexander bangs his head on a pipe. Ubu Morlock seizes him by the neck, smashes his head on a metal component, then lifts him off the ground. Alexander throws a punch. Receiving a second blow, Ubu Morlock just smiles, throws Alexander down and draws a knife. He swipes the blade at Alexander. Alexander punches the knife out of Ubu Morlock's grip, and it's knocked away by one of the spinning panels of the now airborne time machine. Growling, Ubu Morlock grabs Alexander's neck once more and pushes his head towards the rear panel. Alexander thumps a gauge. A powerful white jet of steam gushes into Ubu Morlock's face, and he topples out of the sphere, hanging from Alexander's neck. Alexander grabs the control lever to keep from falling out. Ubu Morlock swings his other arm back into the sphere and locks both hands around Alexander's neck. Alexander grimaces, then pushes the control lever further forward. Alexander watches with wide-eyed amazement, then disgust, as Ubu Morlock's head and body begin to disintegrate. The skin and flesh melt, then the bones break up into tiny fragments and are sucked away into the darkness. Ubu Morlock's forearms are still attached to Alexander's neck. Alexander rips them off and, leaning over to catch his breath, holds his hand to his bloody throat. Looking up, he blinks as an expanding bright yellow light pours from an opening in the blackness. He pulls back the lever. The chronometer clicks onto a seemingly random sequence of numbers, and the panels slow down. The time machine has come to rest on a high ledge, from where Alexander, now standing, takes in his new surroundings. Before him spreads a dark, shadowy, and inhospitable landscape, where cathedral spires of rock reach from a flat, barren valley towards low, forbidding black clouds. Evenly spaced across the floor of the lifeless, dusty valley are a number of giant metal skulls with long, pointed teeth. Inside these gruesome heads, torches of fire burn. Alexander takes the pocket watch, lying on the time machine's red leather chair, and sits down. With the panels spinning steadily behind him, he studies the silver watch, then stares pensively into the distance. In the cave, Mara tries in vain to open the cage door. She suddenly turns around and squints as a bright ball of light across the cave grows into the sphere containing the time machine. Mara watches hopefully as Alexander climbs down, runs over and kicks out the spike which is securing the cage door. Mara jumps into his arms. They look up in alarm as a shadow passes over the steps.
What are you doing with it?
Changing the future.
He attaches the watch chain to the chronometer cogs. The watch jams in the cogs. Alexander and Mara run up the steps through a group of waiting Morlocks who are blinded by the time machine's bright beam. Alexander pulls the gate over the entrance to the cave and pins it in place with a long pole. The Morlocks advance up to the doorway and reach angrily through the bars. The time machine is reaching full power. Alexander and Mara run down a shadowy tunnel, which opens out into the large cavern, where the great furnace blazes. They stop dead and stare. Alexander's eyes dart round the cavern.
Wait here.
Mara retreats gingerly behind a wall of rock. Alexander picks his way round metal girders. A Morlock jumps down behind him, and as Alexander turns, shoots a dart into his shoulder. Mara springs out and whacks the beast round the head with a shovel. Nearby, a Morlock sniffs the air and signals with a roar to the others. Mara drops the shovel, then she and Alexander run up steps through another tunnel. In the barred cave, one of the Morlocks steps inquisitively up to the glowing time machine. Alexander and Mara run on. In the furnace cavern, Morlocks with bloody teeth howl. One by one, they drop onto all fours and bound off like wolves up the steps in pursuit of the two humans. The Morlocks charge at high speed through the damp, gloomy tunnel. Alexander and Mara sprint on, their arms flailing wildly as they race over the uneven, rocky floor. Mara glances anxiously over her shoulder. The Morlocks are hot on their heels. Alexander and Mara run on, ahead of the gaining Morlocks. To quicken their chase, the beasts propel themselves off the tunnel walls. The passageway ends abruptly, and Alexander stops.
Go.
Mara heads off along a cliff track. Alexander pulls off his waistcoat, throws it down, and follows her. The Morlocks come herring round a bend and out into the open. Stopping, they look up and see the two humans scaling the vertical rock face.
Hurry!
In the cave, the trapped Morlocks edge warily up to the time machine. The closest tilts its head curiously. The machine explodes. An energy wave surges through the cave complex, vaporizing all the Morlocks in its path. Mara arrives at the skull statue where Torren and the other Eloy are waiting.
Alexander!
Torren pulls Alexander up out of the statue just before the Morlocks climbing up behind are caught in the blast. The group leaps down onto the ground and run off before the skull disintegrates. White shafts of light spread like wildfire through the surrounding forest. Later, panting with exhaustion, the group stand amongst lush green trees and bushes at the edge of a cliff. They stare incredulously through the darkness at the devastation below, which is shrouded in a whitish haze. Mara turns to Alexander, then steps closer to him and rests a hand on his shoulder, her expression earnest. Alexander faces her.
I'm sorry you lost your machine.
Oh, it's all right. It was only a machine.
Mara smiles softly, then takes his hand in hers and squeezes tightly. Alexander responds and wearily grins. He then turns and stares at the destruction. Now a bright sunny day. By the plaque-lined clock face, children sit listening to Vox, who stands before them.
The congregation rose and stared while the three dead boys came marching up the aisle. Tom in their lead, Joe next, and Huck, a ruin of drooping rags, sneaking sheepishly in the rear. They had hid in the unused gallery listening to their own funeral sermon. Aunt Polly, Mary, and the Harpers threw themselves at
him. Is this the place?
So it is.
Alexander stares ahead. Kaelin goes to his side.
But there's nothing here.
Well, it was different then. My laboratory was all around here. The kitchen was up there, where that tree is. Not that Mrs. Watchett ever let me go in there.
Superimposed, an image of Mrs. Watchett and Philby in the townhouse.
I don't know what to tell you, sir.
They stroll through the lab.
He's been gone this whole week.
And you've no idea where he went?
No, sir.
This would be my greenhouse. There was a garden outside. Grentorm Martes?
Yes.
I'm glad.
Sir?
I'm glad he's gone. Maybe he's finally found some place where he can be happy.
This was my home.
His home.
Long ago.
The woodland fades away.
You know, Molly and I were talking about engaging a housekeeper. Someone to live with us and help take care of Jamie. Would you be interested?
She frowns a little.
Perhaps just until the master returns.
Of course.
But there'd be some changes made. I run a tight house. Oh,
I have no doubt of that. I'll call by in the morning and we'll arrange it. Good night, Mrs. Watchett.
Good night, Mr. Philby.
He leaves through the front door. Mrs. Watchett steps back into the laboratory and switches off the lights. Taking a deep breath, she stares into the darkened room.
Godspeed, my fine lad. Godspeed.
Slipping into the hall, she gently shuts the lab door behind her. Papers, technical drawings, books, tools, and various different kinds of clocks sit on the tables and shelves in the empty laboratory. On one side, a window looks out onto the snow-covered street. In the fading light, Philby walks to the middle of the road, turns sideways, and looks back at the house. He then lifts off his bowler hat, gazes down at it, then flings it briskly away before walking off across the dirty snow. ITFC audio description by Jim Apted.